I am a lifelong Democrat whose family has had 80 years of deep engagement with America's public health bureaucracy and long friendships with key federal regulators, including Anthony Fauci, Francis Collins, and Robert Gallo. Members of my family wrote many of the statutes under which these men govern. They nurtured the growth of equitable and effective public health policies and defended that regulatory bulwark against ferocious attacks funded by industry. I built my own alliances with these individuals and their agencies during my years of environmental and public health advocacy.
Quiet on set. Amber speed.
But I also watched how the industry, supposedly being regulated, used its indentured servants on Capitol Hill and its financial clout to systematically hollow out those agencies beginning in the 1980s, disabling their regulatory function and transforming them into sock puppets for the very industry Congress charged them with regulating. I explore the carefully planned militarization and monetization of medicine that has left American health ailing and our democracy shattered. I chronicle the troubling role of the dangerously concentrated mainstream media.
You're really attacking not only Dr. Anthony Fauci, you're attacking science.
Big Tech, Robert Barron's, the military and intelligence communities, and their deep historical alliance with Big Pharma and the public health agencies. The disturbing story that unfolds here has never been told, and many in power have worked hard to prevent the public from learning it. The principal character is Anthony Fauci.
Today, I will be your master of ceremonies for Event 201. Today's scenario is going to simulate meetings of a multi-stakeholder group called the Pandemic Emergency Board. This board has been urgently convened by the World Economic Forum.
In October of 2019, you have a tabletop simulation that is sponsored by who? The funder is the Gates Foundation, the World Economic Forum, Johns Hopkins School for Security, which is funded by NIH and Gates. The major hosts include not only Gates, but also Avril Haines, who's the former deputy director of the CIA. So what is the CIA doing hosting a simulation on public health? The CIA is not a public health agency. It is an intelligence agency. It does not do public health.
The line between disinformation and misinformation is not always an easy one to find. We shouldn't be trying to control communication, but rather flood the zone. I certainly see the value of communicating constantly on these issues so as to continue to deal with, sort of the vacuum that can be created in this circumstance. All of the disinformation that will be put out, it's going to be important to actually have a response to those questions. There are also intelligence sources identifying multiple foreign disinformation campaigns.
Governments need to be willing to do things that are out of their historical perspective or, for the most part, it's really a war footing that we need to be on.
It can happen quickly. A Marshall-type plan, I don't mean to say that exactly, but a Marshall plan that can go into effect can stimulate a change very quickly.
The distrust relates to the health system more generally.
A step up from the part of the government on enforcement actions against fake news.
I think a couple of things we have to consider are, even before this began, the anti-vaccine movement was very strong. And this is something specifically through social media that has spread. So as we move forward, obviously trust in pharmaceuticals and government is very important at this moment.
The simulation is a simulation of a coronavirus that has escaped and ends up killing 60 million people around the planet. The Chinese government knew of the escape of the virus by September 12, 2019. Curiously, who is there? Is George Gale, who is the head of the Chinese CDC. At that time, George Gale almost certainly knew the coronavirus was circulating.
Infected people got a respiratory illness with symptoms ranging from mild flu-like signs to severe pneumonia. The sickest required intensive care. Many died. It's spreading rapidly throughout local communities. International travel has turned local epidemics into a pandemic spanning the globe.
There are now more than 30,000 reported cases. Experts warn this may be just the beginning of a global problem.
More than half of the recognized cases have required hospital care, creating a huge strain on healthcare systems. The fatality rate is about 10%. Because it appears the virus is readily transmitted through the air from person to person, essentially all people are susceptible. Experts agree unless it is quickly controlled, it could lead to a severe pandemic, an outbreak that circles the globe and affects people everywhere. 2 to 4 times more lethal than the 1918 influenza pandemic, the worst pandemic on record. Even so, some people only exhibit mild flu-like symptoms, not requiring treatment in a hospital. Alarmingly, those people are able to walk around and spread the virus, not realizing they are doing so. Even worse, international travelers have been arriving at their destinations symptom-free, but within a matter of hours, becoming ill. Travel-related cases have blossomed into outbreaks in a number of locations and have quickly grown faster than health authorities could respond and contain them.
I'm joined by immunologist Dr. Yvani Bello and Dr. Raya Blakey, an epidemiologist, both highly respected in their fields.
Researchers are working on a vaccine. Even if we discover a good vaccine candidate, we're starting from scratch, and it takes time to test safety and efficacy, typically years.
We simply cannot rely on these old timelines and processes. With enough money and political will, anything is possible.
Our U.S. affiliate has just released polling results on public expectations for a vaccine. A majority of Americans expect a vaccine to be available within 2 months, and 65% of those polled are eager to take the vaccine, even if it's experimental. In related news, a significant demand for personal protective equipment like N95 masks and gloves are on the rise due to the pandemic. However, globally, hospitals are running low. Additionally, other critical medical supplies such as saline and antibiotics are dwindling. Countries and companies are reportedly stockpiling supplies, disrupting healthcare supply chains, causing dangerous shortages in many parts of the world.
What you just witnessed were highlights from Event 201. This pandemic simulation exercise of the coronavirus took place about 6 weeks before the first illness from the coronavirus was actually reported in Wuhan, China. Now, this simulation also includes news reports, which were fabricated just for this exercise.
A SARS-like virus, which has infected hundreds in China, has now reached the United States.
Some of the city's biggest employers ordering workers to stay home.
We have already started at the NIH and with many of our collaborators on the developing of a vaccine.
I wasn't necessarily surprised when we started to see him in the national limelight.
At the beginning of the pandemic, we really didn't know what it was going to be like and how to manage it and how infectious the virus was. And therefore, a lockdown made sense just to buy a little time to figure out what we should do, what policies we should make, what things needed to be mobilized in order to reduce risk of the infection and actually keep the epidemic as limited as possible.
In comes Tony Fauci, the savior of the West, promoting these actions, lockdowns, masking, etc.
I think many of my fellow Democrats see him as this kind of, particularly during the early COVID pandemic, as this kind of avuncular, soothing figure who was a reassuring counterbalance to Donald Trump's anti-science, narcissistic, you know, bombast.
See if there's any way that you can apply light and heat to cure. But I'm like a person that has a good, you know what.
there was tremendous fear in our country that was orchestrated and generated by the press and by the medical cartel. When people get fearful, their capacity for critical thinking gets disabled. And it's just a human inclination to look for reassurance and leadership from leadership authorities.
He's one that we looked up to at a time when we needed answers. At a time he has a cool, calm, calmness to him, but very factual.
It's called the Fauci effect. I mean, it's nice, but in an era of the normalization of untruths and lies, it's what I symbolize. Consistency for integrity, for truth.
My impression from him, because I had already been dealing with him for 17 years, and I had a skepticism about him because I knew that he was the architect of agency capture within the public health agencies.
With the vaccine, as I use it, I say, help is on the way. It certainly is. But the fact that help is on the way should spur us even more to double down on some of the public health measures. The physical distancing, the universal wearing of masking, the staying away from crowds throughout the country.
But we all thought we were going to die, that this thing was going to sweep through and devastate all of us, which became weaponized for lockdowns. It became weaponized as a rationale for massive infusion of fiat currency into the economy, for causing people to no longer be able to go to work, et cetera, et cetera.
It became apparent after a while that the lockdowns are counterproductive.
And in many ways, COVID restrictions were worse than COVID itself. And so we kept getting news updates. Well, the swimming pool is now closed down. The gym is now closed down.
They use this fear to create the justifications for implementation of all these abrogations of personal liberties and civil rights, such as shutting down businesses and causing to get bankrupt.
Tech companies have benefited massively from pandemic policies that make no medical sense, such as lockdowns, such as not letting us shop in person, not letting us be educated in person, locking kids indoors. Amazon is up 20% net revenue in the last 2 years. Google is up 20 to 25% net revenue. Microsoft is up 20, 25% net revenue. Nintendo is up. All of them crafted or influenced lockdown policies that killed off human assembly, human commerce, human worship, human culture, and drove it all online.
But it may interest you to know, that all the most rigorous scientific studies have found that masks don't prevent transmission of respiratory viruses.
Masks have essentially no benefit. N95 was developed to protect construction workers from dust. Dust particles are removed by those 95% effectively. Dust particles are thousands of times larger than COVID viruses, SARS-CoV-2, and it's like putting ping pong balls through a chain link fence. 95% of the time, they're just going to go straight through.
Dr. Fauci started out by saying correctly that masks don't do any good against respiratory viruses. He said it on 60 Minutes in I think it was March of 2020.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask. When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet. But it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is.
And in saying that, for once, he was actually reflecting the scientific consensus, right? But then a couple months later, he completely flipped. The head of this Chinese CDC, George Gao, having said suddenly, everybody's got to wear a mask, right? Everybody in the West has got to wear a mask, as in China. Then Dr. Fauci shifted.
Masks are protective.
If you look at children outside, particularly when they're with the family, walking down the street, playing a game or what have you, don't have to wear a mask.
The Academy of Pediatric actually makes that recommendation that children should be wearing masks from 2 years old onward.
I mean, I think I've got this right. One mask is better than zero masks. Two masks is better than one mask. But you don't have to have double masks. Is that right? I mean...
Then a couple months later, the World Health Organization shifted because they too had said correctly that that masks don't do anything against respiratory viruses. But then they flipped.
A dispute over a mask led to a woman being tased by a cop at a middle school game. Of course, no, it should have never come to this. What is your right to refuse, and what is law enforcement's ability to enforce?
And you have to have a mask on.
Shoot me, people.
No.
You're going to shoot me for trying not to breathe?
Cool.
Come on, dude.
And there is Barack Obama dancing unmasked. He's been talking about the need to get a vaccine and all the other stuff. I don't think he wants to break from the CDC. What's interesting is I haven't heard the CDC commenting about this yet.
Masks are pretty magical, and they don't have much downside.
People with masks, they give up their individuality. They give up rights as free human beings. You become really, it's the beginning of slavery. African-American slaves in America, many of them, they wore masks. I have called the masks to be the symbolic equivalent of the yellow star that I had to wear. It's a sign that you are not free, that you are lesser. All of this is happening only because people obey.
I think masking really was a symbolic signal not only of obedience, but also that we all should maintain constant fear and that we needed to stay away from each other, from relationships and community. During my childhood, there were duck and cover drills.
Duck and cover, just as you do in your school. We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. You will know when it comes. We hope it never comes, but we must get ready.
We were constantly drilled in school about what would happen when the Russians attacked us with nuclear weapons. That we had to remove sharps from the table. We had to put our head under the desk when we heard the alarm sounding. If you were paranoid, you might feel that the purpose of that drill was to maintain this level of what Bob McNamara later called mass psychosis, where you keep an entire population in fear by constantly reminding them that their lives are under attack. And I think, you know, one of the things that disturbed me about the masking, it was very reminiscent of that.
If one wears a mask, or one stays in a tiny room, and fills up the room with virus, and continues to rebreathe the virus, there is a real chance that one could make a mild illness more severe. Is called re-inoculation. We had gotten a call from Presbyterian Village saying one of the workers contracted COVID. And this was the characteristic pattern in 2020. Remember, the senior citizens in nursing homes, they weren't going out and getting COVID. They were sitting ducks. They were already locked down. And in fact, a worker gave COVID to my dad. We are hearing stories of patients going in the hospital, being locked down in isolation, never seeing their loved ones again, and then dying in the hospital alone.
We don't get to eat dinner with them. We don't get to sit with holidays for them. Memorial Day, Father's Day, Mother's Day.
When COVID sort of broke out across the world, we started trying to learn as much as we could about the disease. You know, we saw it break out in Wuhan, and then Lombardy in Italy, and then Seattle and New York. And I know someone in every ICU in New York City. And it became pretty clear what their main sort of mechanisms of disease were. They were hyperinflamed, and they were clotting to a degree I've never seen before. Nurses were drawing blood. It was clotting in the syringe. And it was clear they needed blood thinners.
When SARS-CoV-2 came to the U.S., predominantly in New York City, patients were getting really sick. They were being admitted to the ICU. They were put on ventilators. And we know the mortality at that time, if you were ventilated in an ICU in New York, was close to 90%.
I was pointing out that I was seeing unprecedented mortality rates and we had to do something. But the general conservatism of medicine was that no, because you might harm someone. It's hard to harm someone when they're dying at rates we've never seen them. They were clearly dying of undertreatment. Because of my efforts were being blocked, and it was clear that I was not welcome, I resigned.
What I did with my dad ultimately became the foundational principles of the McCullough protocols. And the first thing I said is, open the windows. And why? Because we wanted ventilation. We wanted to reduce the viral density in the aerosol of the room. Fresh air was applied for centuries for other respiratory illnesses. Step two, the Indian Medical Society for doctors had already mandated hydroxychloroquine as a standard of care once a week prophylaxis. Zinc 50 milligrams a day had a supportive role. Vitamin D 5,000 international units. Vitamin C 3,000 milligrams a day. Quercetin 500 milligrams twice a day.
By July of 2020, there had been 9 studies of clinical trials, not randomized, of hydroxychloroquine, some by itself, some used with azithromycin and zinc and so on. Every one of those studies showed benefit. The totality of those studies, all analyzed together, showed about a 50% reduced risk of hospitalization and a 75% reduced risk of mortality. Now, these studies are all studies of outpatients, people who get COVID and are treated within the first 5 or 6 days, or started treatment within the first 5 or 6 days. It was a very clear set of data, about as clear as one could ever hope to get.
And yet, Fauci's in the Oval Office saying this is a game changer. And next thing you know, everybody in the country is starting to give it. Supplies are starting to fill hospitals, and they're all giving it.
That the data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery. This will be the standard of care. When I was looking at this data with our team the other night, it was reminiscent of 34 years ago in 1986 when we were struggling for drugs for HIV. And we did the first randomized placebo-controlled trial with AZT, which turned out to give an effect that was modest. But that was not the end game, because building on that every year after, we did better and better.
There's a novel pathogen, and Fauciism always dictates that for some strange reason you throw the most toxic drugs imaginable at it, and you make one of them the kind of reigning king of treatment. Back then it was AZT, now with COVID it's remdesivir, with no feeling or regard or apprehension about the toxicity, while at the same time vilifying, persecuting, creating a whole culture of disinformation about treatments that are older, like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, that doctors in droves are saying is curing people, is getting people out of the hospital, is ending this sickness in a matter of days, if not hours.
And I have to point out, I am severely troubled by the fact that the NIH, the FDA, and the CDC, I do not know of any task force that was assigned or compiled to review repurposed drugs in an attempt to treat this disease. Everything has been about novel and or expensive pharmaceutically engineered drugs, things like remdesivir and vaccines.
The first time I got a call from Senator Johnson's chief of staff that I heard a U.S. senator wanted to talk to me, because he'd come across our website, he'd come across our protocols. Ivermectin did not come into our protocol until much, much later. So it was October of 2020, and suddenly we started to see the trials around ivermectin consistently positive in this very large magnitude, and it was coming from different centers and countries around the world. We were talking to doctors. Doctors were reaching out to us, and he was kind of inspired that he saw some doctors that were putting out treatment guidance when the government was doing nothing.
My entry into the COVID arena, you can say, came about when I saw Pierre Corey's testimony to the State Senate in December 2020. I only saw it on the 26th of December, and I prepared a rapid review and submitted it to the UK authorities on, I think it was the 4th of January. I also sent it to colleagues at the World Health Organization and asked them to pass it on to the COVID team at WHO. And when I didn't get a response by the 7th of January, what's reasonable in a public health emergency, and that is to disseminate information in whatever means possible, And so I did a video appeal to the UK Prime Minister. Dear Prime Minister, my name is Dr. Tess Laurie, and I'm the director of the evidence-based medicine consultancy in Bath. I have recently authored a report called Ivermectin for Preventing and Treating COVID-19, a rapid review to validate the frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance's conclusions. The good news is that we now have solid evidence of an effective treatment for COVID-19. It is called Ivermectin. In connection with its findings, I sent an urgent correspondence to Mr. Hancock and other members of Parliament on Monday, the 3rd of January. Unfortunately, I have not yet had a reply, and due to the urgent implications of the report, I'm trying to reach you via this video. Please may we start saving lives now.
I was invited to give a lecture at an international conference on ivermectin. And on the third day, a PhD named Andrew Hill gave a lecture and said that he was from the WHO. And I reached out to him, and Andy and I became very fast and close colleagues. And he was as taken with the data as we were.
I was introduced to Andrew Hill by Dr. Pierre Corey in that first week of January. He had been working with Pierre Corey to present the evidence to the NIH that week. Pierce said, you know, you really must meet him. He's the WHO consultant working on ivermectin. And Andrew Hill agreed to be on the team with us. But then that weekend, his own review was published on a preprint server. Now, this was a great cause for concern because it was clearly rushed. It was very poor quality with all these obvious flaws. I emailed him and I said, Andrew, this is going to cause immeasurable harm. Please retract this review and let's talk. I can help you correct these errors.
I'm in a very sensitive position here.
Whose conclusions are those on the review that you've done?
Who's
not listed as an author? Who's actually contributed?
Well, I mean, I don't really want to get into it. I mean,
it needs to be clear. I would like to know who are these other voices that are in your paper that are not acknowledged?
Unitaid has a say in the conclusions of the paper, yeah.
So they have a say in your conclusions?
Yeah. But the FDA regulations is predicated by the fact that there's no effective alternative therapy. So if ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine were declared effective treatment for SARS-CoV-2, it would have invalidated the vaccine. The vaccines would not have been allowed to get an EUA.
The suppression of early treatment through the press and through various government outlets, including the FDA, is a crime. We have a significant unnecessary burden of loss of life due to the withholding of early treatments, including treatment with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. It has caused unnecessary human death.
We're so sort of hypnotized by those names, the New York Times, CNN. This is CNN. We're mesmerized by that based on their long records as widely recognized, authoritative, reputable news sources. There was that amazing face-off between CNN and Joe Rogan when some of their lying heads had said that he was taking horse paste.
To have individuals like Joe Rogan, for example, who don't want to take an experimental vaccine but will take horse dewormer.
Rogan telling his 13 million Instagram followers that he was treated with several drugs, and he included ivermectin on the list, a drug used for livestock.
Joe Rogan, he came down with COVID. He says he's been taking the livestock dewormer ivermectin.
That was an attempt to take him down and to misrepresent ivermectin. And he fought back because that's in his nature.
Does it bother you that the news network you work for out and out lied?
Well,
just outright lied about me taking horse dewormer.
Calling it a horse dewormer is not a flattering thing, I get
that. It's a lie. It's a lie on a news network. You're working for a news organization. If they're lying about a comedian taking horse medication, what are they telling us about Russia? What are they telling us about Syria? Do you understand that that's why people get concerned about the veracity of the news?
The reliability of the media, a recent poll that says it's almost at an all-time low. We should look at news sources that are outside of this matrix of treachery, because it's there in order to accept advertising and lobbying money from established corporate sources, which means it has to operate compliantly and in alliance with the government. So you're not going to get honest information from those sources.
So they kept saying ivermectin is a horse paste. Well, when he got, it's, of course it's not. It's kind of a miracle drug. And, they were even thinking it could cure cancer before COVID happened. And, then COVID happened and then they had to demonize it right away because it's cheap. Nobody can make money off ivermectin. It's a generic. And so the company that invented it, Merck, they can't make money off it because now anybody can make it.
There is an alternative media. That is true. It is something that has emerged very suddenly and recently, right? Joe Rogan represents that. Jimmy Dore represents that. Podcasters have basically filled the breach that's been left by the left press. There will always be some outlets, I think, that try to tell the awful truth.
And we learned something else about COVID. One day the test is positive, the next day the test is negative. A week later the test is positive, a week later the test is negative.
So is a PCR test not a good barometer either?
Yeah, that is a very good question.
It's pretty obvious if you look objectively at the data that the CDC is totally manipulating this pandemic, and they did it from day one. One of the most egregious examples of this is the test that they, the very test they use to diagnose a case or someone who's infected with the virus. The test was a PCR test, and it amplifies the amount of agent that you want to check for.
Carrie Mullis was the inventor of PCR. He was not the inventor of the PCR test. There is no test for either AIDS or COVID. As Carrie Mullis said, it doesn't test for anything. It finds what you tell it to find. And he always said, that doesn't tell you whether you're infected with anything. It doesn't tell you whether you're likely to get sick from anything. It doesn't tell you anything. And the overwhelming data about PCR tests and COVID shows that there is a shoddy, at best, correlation between positive PCR tests and disease outcome. So why did they use PCR for COVID?
I mean, how can people actually tell if they are contagious in the cycle of having COVID? How do you measure that if not with either a PCR test or an antigen test?
And I think that's the understandable confusion that people have about testing. Testing saying whether you're infected or not versus are you infected plus transmissible.
COVID began in China as a pneumonia. And for some reason, we were reading in the papers that something like 53 people in Wuhan, China had some kind of novel pneumonia they hadn't seen before. And because I'm alert to propaganda, I got very anxious. I thought, why are we reading about pneumonias in China? We don't ever read about pneumonias in China. Why are we reading about these?
In the first week in January, I got a call from Michael. He's a former DARPA project officer, and literally he is our top expert in gain-of-function research and has been so for years and years and has long been deeply embedded as one of our top biodefense/biowarfare experts, who was in Wuhan at the time in the first week in January. And he warned me, he said, Robert, you need to get your team spun up because we've got a problem. This coronavirus looks like it's going to be a major issue.
And my question is, have you seen anything at this point that gives you a high degree of confidence that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the origin of this virus?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And I think that the World Health Organization should be ashamed of themselves.
The Fauci emails themselves, as I understand it, it was involved in trying to cover up origins of COVID. And trying to say it was a zoonotic origin, and there's no way the lab leak theory had any credence to it.
At 2:47 in the early morning of February 1st, 2020, 4 hours after his loyal grantee, virologist Christian Anderson, informed Dr. Fauci that he and other leading biologists believed that the genetic sequence was highly unlikely to be the product of natural selection, Dr. Anthony Fauci fired off a carefully worded email to Catholic. Dr. Fauci's other emails from that evening suggest that he was intensely worried that the Chinese experiments that may have created this striation and novel coronavirus would bear his fingerprints.
I first heard about this amazing story concerning the use of burner phones by Jeremy Farrar, Tony Fauci, and Francis Collins right after the initiation of the outbreak from the memoir that Jeremy Farrar, who's the head of the Wellcome Trust, one of the largest sources of funding for British biotechnology and vaccine development. Why Farrar was in that loop, I infer, is because he had some role in providing the funding to the Wuhan Laboratory Institute of Virology that had been involved in that research. He disclosed in his autobiography that he and Tony and Francis Collins had used burner phones to avoid any trail that would be able to document their conversations immediately after the initiation of the outbreak. And he spoke about that in the context of talking about their fears and collusion in trying to cover up what they knew about the work that had gone on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
The U.S. intelligence agencies now believe that the Chinese knew that the virus had escaped from the Wuhan lab by September 12th. That it probably escaped sometime in late August, early September, but on September 12th, the military went into that lab at night and they changed the leadership of the lab. They took 22,000 coronavirus samples and removed them, and they've never been seen again. They removed mention of many of the gain-of-function studies from the public-facing websites. The intelligence agencies in the U.S. and Great Britain and Europe, they call the Five Eyes, the Western nations who all share intelligence with each other, all had deep involvement not only in funding these studies at the Wuhan lab, but also in the cover-up of protecting the countermeasures and protecting the Wuhan lab against nosy investigations. In August of 2020, I gave a speech to the Peace and Justice Rally in Berlin.
Governments love pandemics. This is taking time for nothing.
I estimated crowds were about 1 million democracy advocates. There were people from every nation in Europe and every color of the rainbow, and they came together to demand the return of their constitutional and human rights.
The only thing a government needs to make people into slaves is fear.
Immediately after that, the German intelligence agencies and the British intelligence agencies announced that they were considering vaccine hesitancy a form of terrorism, and that they were unleashing their cyber warfare arsenal on people in foreign countries who they consider vaccine hesitant. It's illegal for the CIA to spy on American citizens in this country, but the way that the CIA has always gotten around that stricture is by outsourcing the spying on U.S. citizens to Five Eye nations like Great Britain and Germany, with whom they share the intelligence. So they don't have to spy on, you know, us. They can get the Brits and the Germans to do it, and then they can get the intelligence that way. And it's disturbing that, you know, that people are simply questioning government policies, important government policies that affect the health and well-being of millions and millions of American children and adults, are treated as enemies of the state.
Is this very famous French microbiologist and clinician Didier Raoult, who actually published, you know, some of the earliest data showing the effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine is effective against the multiplication of four different species of coronavirus in cells. That may be a very good candidate to treat the patients. Reported that not only it works on patients, but also that there was a clearance of the virus in 4 days.
But again, you know, this was going against the narrative. Previously, hydroxychloroquine was available over the counter in France to censor him and silence him. This was removed from over the counter.
propaganda always entails censorship. It must. Because propaganda, again, does not seek to persuade. It seeks to push you, to jolt you into a particular point of view. So it doesn't try to make arguments. It doesn't try to make a reasonable case. It doesn't use reason at all, actually. It tends to be a kind of almost neurological manipulation. Now, because propaganda doesn't tolerate argument, it always entails extremely rigorous censorship of the counter-narrative. It must be vilified, it must be condemned, it must be blacked out.
Will you provide a list of every website and hashtag that Facebook content moderation teams have discussed banning on the Task platform?
I would be happy to follow up with you or your team to discuss further how we might move forward on that. But
will you commit to providing the information you have logged on the Task website about content moderation that your company has undertaken? Yes or no?
Senator, I think it would be better to follow up once I've had a chance to discuss with my team what any sensitivity around that would be.
We could, of course, subpoena this information, but I'd much rather get it from you voluntarily. But I think let everybody take note that Mr. Zuckerberg has now repeatedly refused to provide information that he knows that he has and has now acknowledged.
Just to clear up one point, I mean, my understanding is that these vaccines do not modify your DNA or RNA. So I think that's just an important point to clarify. If I'm getting anything wrong here, of course, correct me, but just to make that clear.
I share some caution on this because we just don't know the long-term side effects of basically modifying people's DNA and RNA to directly encode in a person's DNA and RNA, basically the ability to produce those antibodies, and whether that causes other mutations or other risks downstream.
But the real kicker is right here in the policy where Facebook says it would remove any content that, quote, claims the COVID-19 vaccine changes people's DNA.
Dr. Fauci collaborated with Mark Zuckerberg. There were emails between them, and this is a complete conflict because Facebook is invested in the vaccines. Google is invested in the vaccines. They have a conflict of interest. Microsoft makes the vaccine passports. And yet Dr. Fauci, who's not supposed to be coordinating health policy with for-profit stakeholders who have a conflict of interest, he was taking input and apparently aligning his message with what these tech bros wanted to have happen.
In 2020, many of the Gates-Fauci HIV vaccine trials in Africa suddenly became COVID-19 vaccine trials as the unprecedented tsunami of new COVID-19 plunder began flowing through Dr. Fauci to the same disciplined legions of the virology caste. The one-size-fits-all approach to solving the problems of poverty and disease is a failed approach. Poverty is the result of a complex conspiracy of economic factors, of cultural factors, of food production, of political issues, and governance issues. The idea that you can come in with a technological intervention and solve the problems of human poverty is a dangerous myth. And one of the great injuries that I think that Tony Fauci and Bill Gates have perpetrated is steering the World Health Organization away from its traditional concerns with economic development, with agriculture, with local governance and education, those holistic issues of developing locally rooted solutions to local problems of poverty and health, and steered the WHO toward the kind of single preoccupation with vaccines.
And we're taking things that are, you know, genetically modified organisms, and we're injecting them in little kids' arms. We just shoot them right into the vein.
The Bill Gates apparatus, they're worse than colonial powers, because the colonial powers at least built some infrastructure that was useful and helpful. And pharmacolonialism specifically is you will have nothing to say about how to treat illness in your country. That will be dictated by us. And once we've put our dictatorship into your country is effectively invaded in a sense. It's colonized by us. And I saw that when I crossed Africa, that there were CDC vans, and wherever they had shown up, went to the top of each government, not hard to do, corrupted the government.
One of my email contacts told me that in the town where he was from in Zambia, hydroxychloroquine is over the counter, and yet it had disappeared from the shelves, that somebody came in and bought up all of the hydroxychloroquine. You have to understand that in Africa, hydroxychloroquine is an anti-malarial. It's used for malaria. It's called Sunday Sunday because it's taken once a week. You know, Sunday is a typical day. It's like a vitamin virtually in those countries. And yet suddenly it disappeared off all the shelves, and there were bonfires outside of the town.
The wait is now finally over for the people of the United States. And according to the authorities, the first phase of the highly awaited Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine rollout is all set to start from Monday onwards. But the U.S. Army General Gustav Perner, who is currently acting as the Chief Operating Officer of the government's Operation Warp Speed program, said on Saturday that the first shots of the vaccine campaign will be administered as early as Monday morning.
We expect 145 sites across all the states to receive vaccine on Monday, another 425 sites on Tuesday, and the final 66 sites on Wednesday, which will complete the initial delivery of the Pfizer orders for vaccine.
So the first thing you might want to say to my African-American brothers and sisters is that the vaccine that you're going to be taking was developed by an African-American woman.
Early on, after the vaccine rollout began, we began to see a wave of deaths, particularly in senior citizens and elderly, who were the first people to get the vaccine. And one of these deaths was Hank Aaron, who I knew was, you know, the MLB superstar.
It was a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
And Hank Aaron did a press conference at CDC's urging in Atlanta, which is the home of CDC. He did a press conference in which he got the vaccine on TV telling African Americans, you need to do what I do. The vaccine is safe. Here, I'm going to take it in front of you. Well, 17 days later, he died. And I wrote an article saying his death is part of a wave of deaths that we're seeing in elderly after vaccination. I didn't say that his death was caused by the vaccine because I can't say that. Scientifically, I didn't have the information to be able to say that, but I could say with certitude and scientific certainty that his death was among many deaths that were being reported immediately after vaccination. Well, I was attacked by CDC and by the New York Times and USA Today and all of the television networks and news organizations around the world.
Now, remember, the NFL has a vaccine mandate. Aaron Rodgers develops COVID-19. Wait a minute. You took the vaccine. He's like, no, I didn't. I didn't take the vaccine. I got COVID. He got the McCullough protocol. He goes on with Pat McAfee. I got the McCullough protocol. I got through it. Thanks, Dr. McCullough. And it's revealed he hasn't gotten the vaccine. And why? Because he's concerned about myocarditis. And Cole Beasley for the Buffalo Bills, same thing. And Kyrie Irving plays in New York for basketball. Same thing. So we have player after player coming out saying, listen, I am worried about myocarditis. And then you see the array of damage.
Baker County High School senior is in the hospital after collapsing on the tennis courts.
Breaking new details on the deaths of a high school soccer player.
Finland, Denmark star man Christian Eriksson collapsing towards the end of the first half.
The Kennedy High community mourning tonight after one of their high school football players died.
A South Carolina high school football player has died after collapsing at football practice.
Star college basketball player collapsing on the court. We want to warn you, the video may be difficult to watch.
Florida Gators star Keontae Johnson collapsing during the game.
A West Catholic high school student has died after collapsing during a football scrimmage.
On mile 8, she suddenly felt fuzzy and blacked out.
17-year-old Ryan Jacobs' heart stopped.
Unexpectedly collapsed on the field.
Megan went into cardiac arrest.
Collapsing during Friday night's football game.
This is a gigantic experiment they were doing on the entire world's population. It's never been used before in humans.
The side effects for the Moderna vaccine sound concerning. We looked. After the second dose, at least 80% of participants experienced a systemic side effect. So, are these vaccines safe?
Well, the FDA, not being pressured, will look hard at that. The FDA is the gold standard of regulators, and their current guidance on this, if they stick with that, is very, very appropriate.
They have been working on this technology for a long time, but they've had a lot of problems with it. They haven't been able to get it to where it can work. It's too toxic. And they see this as a tremendous opportunity. And Fauci sees it, Bill Gates sees it. They've been heavily vested in this mRNA technology as a new revolutionary concept in biology, in medicine.
When you woke up this morning, did you know you're going to be receiving the vaccine?
I did, yes. Okay. So, you know, all of my staff, we are excited to get the vaccine, you know. I'm sorry, I'm feeling really dizzy. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll sit down. Okay. Whoa. You okay?
The mRNA vaccines work by taking genetic material in the vaccine that's encapsulated in a little microscopic particle and having that particle infect your cells. And that means that the particle is transferred from the outside of your cells to the inside. So it uses your cells, your body, to complete the vaccine manufacturing. It's completed by your body's genetic machinery and not the manufacturer's.
The mRNA that I was working with and the inventions that I came up with are fundamentally different from what's being used in the current product, in that I was producing what is close to being a natural RNA. What's being used in the emergency use authorized products from Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech are not natural RNAs, so they are related to what I'd originally envisioned, but also different. And those differences seem to have contributed to the risks and toxicities.
Messenger RNA is made by our cells every single day. It's made by our DNA. And what messenger RNA does is it's a delivery of a recipe. The DNA has a recipe that it writes on the messenger RNA, because remember, it takes messages. So it has a recipe on the front of it that says, make this protein for healing this muscle. And the messenger RNA then goes over to the ribosomes, which is the factory, and it reads the recipe on the front of the messenger RNA and creates the protein, which then goes out into the body and goes over to the muscle that's been injured and hurt and repairs it. That's normal DNA, messenger RNA, that happens every day, every minute in our cells all day long.
One of the fascinating and terrifying things we've seen over the last 2 years is that there have been more injuries and deaths reported from COVID shots in the official VAERS systems, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, than for all vaccines combined over the last 30 years. All the vaccines, hepatitis, measles, polio, DPT, you name it. There have been more injuries and more deaths in the last 2 years from COVID shots.
In September of 2000, when I started investigating problems associated with vaccines, there were about 8,000 VAERS reports per year. The last time I looked before COVID, it was about 35,000 reports per year. And if that's somewhere between 1 and 10% of actual injuries, we could be talking about somewhere between 350,000 and 3.5 million people who are actually injured and were unfamiliar with filing a VAERS complaint.
There are a number of reasons that it's underreported. It's a very cumbersome system. It's difficult to use. It's difficult to get data in. And it takes time. And clinicians are reluctant to put data into the VAERS system. So there should be a much more proactive system where the federal government, if they were interested, would more closely track the adverse events related to these vaccines.
Dr. Fauci's refusal to fix the Health and Human Services Department's notoriously dysfunctional Vaccine Injury Surveillance System, VAERS, constituted inexcusable negligence. HHS's own studies indicate that VAERS may be understating vaccine injuries by over 99%.
The VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, tells me that there has been a lot of very bad side effects.
The initial safety study, Mark, is to see if I inject it in the arm, does it have some sort of idiosyncratic or bad reaction.
I had my COVID jab on the 17th of March. That left me with seizures and I was paralyzed. It's left me with tic attacks.
Got my COVID vaccine, Pfizer, on Monday, and Thursday I had Bell's palsy.
There's another element to safety, and that is if you vaccinate someone and they make an antibody response, and then they get exposed and infected, does the response that you induce actually enhance the infection and make it worse? And the only way you'll know that is if you do an extended study, not in a normal volunteer who has no risk of infection, but in people who are out there in a risk situation.
I'm so scared.
This would not be the first time, if it happened, that a vaccine that looked good in initial safety actually made people worse. There was the history of the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine in children, which paradoxically made the children worse. One of the HIV vaccines that we tested several years ago actually made individuals more likely to get infected.
If you take it and then a year goes by and everybody's fine, then you say, okay, that's good. Now let's give it to 500 people. And then a year goes by and everything's fine. You say, well, then now let's give it to thousands of people. And then you find out that it takes 12 years for all hell to break loose. And then what have you done?
The university is requiring all students and workers to get vaccinated and verify the status of their booster vaccination by the date of January 21st.
Mario, you have to show proof you're vaccinated. You can't eat indoors at Philadelphia restaurants and bars.
Big changes ahead for restaurants and many other businesses in Chicago beginning tomorrow. Vaccination mandate goes into effect.
If you want to eat out or work out in three suburbs, you have an extra week before you need to flash that vax card.
Please get vaccinated.
My daughter took that shot yesterday in Las Vegas and she's dead. She took the Pfizer vaccine and she's dead.
Given the fact that we now have the virus in our hands, it is quite possible, in fact, it's invariable, that we will develop a vaccine for AIDS.
Fauci's reign begins in 1984. Everything changes in 1984.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Robert Gallo held a press conference in which it was declared by the U.S. government that the U.S. government had found the cause of AIDS at the National Cancer Institute where Gallo worked.
The probable cause of AIDS has been found, a variant of a known human cancer virus.
and that it was to be called human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. The same year, 1984, Fauci becomes the director of the NIAID.
This saw the rise of Dr. Fauci to his current stardom.
I would like to introduce Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984.
Dr. Fauci understood that he could basically save his government agency by defining AIDS as an infectious disease. His agency within the NIH is all about the study of what allergies and infectious diseases. And infectious diseases were kind of on the way out because they'd mostly been conquered by the time Fauci came along, needing to reopen the spigot of funding for his agency and his allies in Big Pharma.
Mr. President and Commissioners, that it is clear that very soon, certainly within this calendar year in the United States, we will be doing early phase one testing for safety in vaccines. We have NIH-funded, federal government-sponsored vaccine evaluation units. It's a good collaboration between industry, the federal government, and academia.
What's not known to most people, and would be surprising to many, not all, is that Dr. Fauci and others at the NIH are in partnership. They have patents, pharmaceutical patents, and they're in partnership with the companies. Their official job is to serve the public interest. But that has been sort of set aside, brushed away as if that's only a formality.
The 1985 Dole Act allowed NIAID and Dr. Fauci personally to file patents on the hundreds of new drugs that his agency-funded PIs were incubating, and then to license those drugs to pharmaceutical companies and collect royalties on their sales.
Well, my uncle, Teddy, deliberately and purposely brought in as his chief administrative aide Terry Byrne, who was the first openly gay administrative aide on Capitol Hill. He was also the first openly HIV-infected administrative aide on Capitol Hill, and this was very controversial at that time because people were terrified of being exposed, even to people who they believed were maybe infected with HIV.
Think about it. Here we had this new disease that you could have without being aware of it. This gave rise to media scare stories about getting AIDS from toilet seats and stuff like that.
The public seems to have its toughest time in separating fact from fiction.
Can children contact AIDS by drinking fountains?
I would like to know if you can contact AIDS by kissing, touching, or just being around someone that has the disease.
Well, as you know, there have been reports that the virus can occasionally be found in saliva.
And in New Jersey, officials say that they will allow school superintendents to suspend students, teachers, or other staff who are suffering from AIDS.
There is considerable talk about mandatory reporting of all AIDS cases and required blood tests, and much agonizing over the question of quarantine.
Well, for example, if the close contact of a child is a household contact, perhaps there will be a certain number of cases of individual who are just living with and in close contact with someone with AIDS, but just the ordinary close contact that one sees in normal interpersonal relationships. If that's the case, then indeed the implications for the spread to even other groups besides infants and children's become something that needs to be reckoned with. So I think it is going to have a major impact on our thinking about what the real confines of the syndrome will be.
And when I say Anthony Fauci is essentially a social engineer, I mean that. Because what he does, he re-engineers how people think of human contact, touch, intimacy.
You know about pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
You know how I feel about responsibility.
Yes.
How much do you know about AIDS?
We have a long way to go in the fight against HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. HIV is spread by sharing needles and through sex with an infected person.
When it came to sex, Cindy was the life of the party. She went from one partner to another, until one day she met a partner who'd stay with her for the rest of her life. AIDS. Don't experiment with sex. If you do, use a condom, or being the life of the party could be the death of you.
The scourge of AIDS is fast becoming the most socially charged health issue of the decade.
What you see there is a kind of, I would say, almost like an earthquake moment in time, in American culture, biology, virology, politics, everything.
It was a disease that was so horrendous and terrifying that it necessitated people staying away from each other. No more sexual contact, no more casual sexual contact.
Not only sex, all forms of human contact. And now all of a sudden, as though a switch has turned, now it represents death and potentially murdering somebody that you love. I mean, these are really radical ideas and very dark ideas.
Given the long incubation period of this disease, we may be starting to see, as we're seeing virtually as the months go by, other groups that can be involved. And seeing it in children is really quite disturbing.
It used to be that Anthony Fauci, Robert Gallo, and all of them told the American people, if you test positive today, you are probably going to die within 6 months to a year. Then it became 3 years, then it became 5 years, then it became 10 years, and they kept stretching it and stretching it.
You needed to be tested in order to know that you have it, and you needed to be tested with PCR technology. Does it sound familiar? And its inventor, Carey Mullis, was beside himself with anger that it was being used to diagnose people with HIV, which was then supposed to lead inexorably to AIDS. He spoke out against this at the time.
Guys like Fauci get up there and start talking. You know, he doesn't know anything really about anything. And I'd say that to his face. Nothing. The man thinks you can take a blood sample and stick it in an electron microscope, and if it's got a virus in there, you'll know it. He doesn't understand electron microscopy, and he doesn't understand medicine, and should not be in a position like he's in.
He repeatedly said, including on tape, you should not use the PCR test to diagnose clinical infection with viruses. He repeatedly said that. What are we doing? Using the PCR test to distinguish clinical diagnostic tests with viruses.
They've got a personal kind of agenda. They make up their own rules as they go. They change them when they want to. And they smugly, like Tony Fauci, does not mind going on television in front of the people who pay his salary and lie directly into the camera.
When Bob Gallo proved that it was the etiologic agent in 1984, we had a diagnostic test approved by the FDA in 1985. That was really quick, from literally less than a year from the time that it was shown to be the virus that causes this disease.
My mentor as a young undergraduate actually traveled with Bob Gallo to the Pasteur Institute and met with Luc Montagnier and brought back their DNA isolate that could be used to produce the AIDS virus.
Luc Montagnier sent a biological sample, let's just say, to Robert Gallo for his feedback in 1983. Robert Gallo famously held those demonstrably same proteins up at the press conference where he declared that HIV had been found in his lab and was the cause of AIDS.
Credit must go to our eminent doctor, Robert Gallo.
And a massive battle ensued.
I went over to Montagnier afterwards and I said, I can't find a reference. Like, I can't find a reference to go with the statement HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. I'm sure you can help me. He said, why don't you use the NIH, like the CDC report? And I said, well, I looked at that and that was not a scientific paper. And the people standing around, by the way, who were his colleagues there, looked at him like they were thinking he should come up with a better answer, but he couldn't.
Luc Montagnier was always an interesting figure and always a thorn in the side of the orthodoxy.
HIV by itself, or some strains of HIV, are not sufficient to induce AIDS. Even from the beginning, actually, we thought maybe for the activation of that virus in cells, we need some cofactors.
Cofactors are not necessary.
I think a lot of the data point to, at best, HIV being a cofactor. and one of the human herpes viruses may play a key role in the development of that disease to the extent that it is attributable to a virus infection. Nevertheless, Dr. Fauci, of course, has been long committed to the belief system that HIV is the sole cause of a immunodeficiency virus syndrome.
There was a war that I covered from the first shot fired, which was in 1987 with Peter Duisberg's paper, that most people do not know took place. A war that took place over the soul of American science, the classical science world, where you have to prove what you're saying, and not until you've proven it do you move forward. And the postmodern, post-Faucian, industrial, hyper-monetized, hyper-propagandized, non-scientific world.
HIV cannot be the cause of AIDS because it doesn't infect enough cells and isn't active enough. It's only found in 1 out of 8,000 T cells.
It's really unfortunate because what he's doing, he's creating a tremendous amount of anxiety in the people who are infected because they think that there's some conspiracy among scientists against them. It really is very unfortunate. And coming from him, who has, he has some qualifications. Something happened to him in his thinking over the past couple of years. I don't know what it is.
HIV was never present by any means in all cases of AIDS, but Anthony Fauci made sure that there was a perfect correlation by eliminating about 5,000 HIV negative AIDS cases. There was a conference in Amsterdam in the early 1990s, an AIDS conference. Doctors started to go to the podium in a session where they were talking about HIV negative AIDS, and they began to say, yeah, I have some too. I have a clinical AIDS patient, has every symptom but test negative on every test, no matter how many times they test. And so there was a clamor, there was a sense of anxiety. Wait a minute, what is this? Could it be that Peter Duisberg is right? And Anthony Fauci flew in on Air Force Two to that conference, and he did his thing, and he quashed it. He just quashed it. He gave a statement through Newsweek that this just wasn't an issue. It was a misunderstanding. And what they did at that moment was they took all of the HIV negative AIDS cases and they renamed them and threw them out of the official definition.
In a brazen move to explain away the anomaly of AIDS without HIV, Dr. Fauci declared that the unexplained AIDS cases represented a new disease. To avoid suspicion that his, quote, new disease, end quote, was, after all, chronic fatigue syndrome, Dr. Fauci labeled his discovery idiopathic CD4 plus lymphocytopenia, or ICL. In this tongue twister, idiopathic means of unknown source.
I did not know whether HIV AIDS was the thing that was the force that killed all of these people in the 80s and 90s. What we do know is that there was a deliberate, purposeful effort that was orchestrated by Tony Fauci, a crusade to silence dissidents, to make sure the debate didn't happen, to make sure that science that challenged the official orthodoxy was suppressed, that people who voiced that science had their careers destroyed, that they were silenced, that they were vilified, that they were marginalized, that they were ridiculed, that they were made radioactive.
The publisher said, you know, this is the Vietnam of our generation, so I'm going to designate a column. And I became the editor of that column and often the writer of the column.
Frustration over the AIDS crisis spilled over into a big protest today at City Hall in Manhattan. More than 2,000 people demanding action.
An estimated 1 million people in the United States have HIV. That number could grow exponentially starting tomorrow.
Fire Fauci.
We need drugs! Release the drugs!
It's a story about racism, This is a story about sexism. This is a story about greed. And this is war. And the National Institutes of Health are refusing to do their job.
I don't have access to these trials. The criteria are too tight. They take too long. And every day I read about drugs that are available, and they're not going to trial. There's no access to any new drugs. And I'm coming here to ask for access to these drugs.
The FDA will move as quickly as possible to address this issue and expand the indication for AZT.
He didn't even blink. This was entirely second nature to him, to unblinkingly get on television night after night and speak of this incredibly toxic chemical, and I mean really toxic.
People with asymptomatic HIV infection.
Since AZT is a drug that's already on the market, physicians can at their discretion prescribe it for whatever it is that they want to prescribe it for.
Anthony Fauci made a decision at a certain point and came out with it that anybody with CD4 cells lower than 500, though they were still healthy and not symptomatic of AIDS, should go on AZT as a preventive measure.
All participants whose T4 counts are less than 500 should be offered AZT.
I knew that the drug had come out of an anti-cancer program. It's a modified nucleic acid. Our DNA and RNA are made of these little chemical bases, and when you modify some of them, they can jam the machinery of cells replicating. That's how a lot of chemotherapy drugs work, and this is just the same.
One person I interviewed, his brother was perfectly healthy and had been persuaded to go on a high dose of AZT, and he was dead within a year, but also his face melted away. It's like Hiroshima. Very powerful radiation.
He was diagnosed. He had advanced AIDS, near death, just months to live, massive infections in his lungs, all over his body, Kaposi sarcoma, lesions on his skin, high titers of the virus all throughout his body. And instead of being dead today, as most of the people taking AZT were by undergoing hyperthermia at the University of Rome, today he is alive and well. There is a successful series of treatments. I use the word treatments. There's no one treatment I think is better than any other. Hyperthermia, vitamin C drips, ozone treatment.
I had taken my medical records down to the National Institutes of Health, to Dr. Fauci's lab, and showed them, because they have presently discredited this treatment. And that's why our federal government has not allowed it here in the United States as of yet. Showed them my medical records. And what I did is I blanked out a set that had my name on it, showed them and said, well, what do you think of this? Their response is, well, this person obviously got better. What did they do?
Fauciism is an absolute contempt for natural non-toxic therapies, a contempt for the whole dialectic and discussion about what is an immune system, what is health, how do you detoxify, what does it mean when you're getting sick from a chronic illness? Is it just a matter of attacking the accused pathogen with the most toxic drugs kind of imaginable? AZT at the time was the most toxic drug that had ever been put in a capsule and given to human beings.
My uncle and Terry Byrne spent a lot of time meeting with Tony Fauci and trying to persuade him to have a parallel track.
Their proposal was to create a parallel track approval system that would allow community AIDS doctors to conduct clinical studies on off-the-shelf drugs that neither pharma nor NIAID wanted to test.
AZT at that time was headed to be the most expensive drug in history. It would cost $10,000 for a year of treatment. And for that drug to function, Burroughs Wellcome had to make sure that there were no competitors in the marketplace. Part of the strategy for the NIAID, for Anthony Fauci, and for his partners at Burroughs Wellcome, was to make sure that those drugs did not get FDA approval because it would have killed AZT.
AZT was approved in a way that I have said it kind of broke the spine of the FDA tradition, the FDA drug approval tradition that had reigned up to that point, where it took up to 10 years, roughly, for a drug to be considered adequately tested for both safety and efficacy. I don't think the FDA drug approval process prior to that was probably all that safe or great, but at least it was something. You had to prove safety if you're the FDA, and you had to prove efficacy for a new drug. That all ended with AZT.
When I was at the Wellcome Research Labs, I was very proud to be in a place that had discovered the first drug that became allegedly useful for AIDS. I knew that they had found a new way to use an oncology drug, and I thought, well, well done to them. I had no idea. I was like 28. I'm just, you know, very happy. I'd never heard of Dr. Fauci at that time. I didn't know it was expensive, and I definitely didn't know it was that it was really poisoning people.
Neither NIAID nor Burroughs Wellcome ever completed any long-term animal study. Burroughs Wellcome financed Dr. Fauci's fast-track human trials, fragmenting their study groups in 12 cities into small cohorts, making safety signals difficult to detect. In 1987, Dr. Fauci's team declared the human study a success and terminated it after only 4 months of a proposed 6-month study, a record-setting speed for chemotherapy approval. That 4-month observation period was far too short for researchers to detect side effects that would occur in patients taking AZT for years or even for a lifetime. Arthur Ashe died, and when Rudolf Nureyev died, and many, many other friends of mine who died during that period, during the 80s and 90s of AIDS, my assumption was that AIDS was killing these people. I was completely unaware, really, until I wrote this book, that there was an alternative narrative. Many doctors and scientists and activists believed that it was actually the majority of those men were dying because of AZT poisoning. Arthur Ashe himself suspected that it was the AZT that was killing him and not his HIV infection. Both he and Nureyev were healthy until they began taking AZT.
Public health colonialism enables us to show up in third world countries, demand that their leadership tell the people that they are all about to die of a terrible new disease, and we have to get in there and we take over, protecting the needy and the poor, and especially people in third world countries, from this terrible virus.
I worked in South Africa, you know, at the height of the AIDS epidemic. It was a pretty terrifying time. We didn't really understand what it is. So these poor people would get overwhelming infections, they'd get pneumocystis, pneumonia, and they would die. And we were helpless.
And oh, we have to give them AZT, and we have to give them drugs, and we have to give them vaccines.
We thought this was the answer to the AIDS epidemic. You know, we had no idea how toxic it was. We had no idea how ineffective it was. We had no idea how Fauci et al. Had manipulated the data and how they were experimenting on these poor people.
I had an intense interest in Africa from when I was a little boy. Probably that amplified when I was 7 years old. My father came back from a trip to Africa with a film called Africa Speaks, and he showed it on the little 16-millimeter projector that we had in our basement. And I just fell in love with the continent. I ended up going to Africa beginning in 1964 many, many times. I I met over my lifetime with many African leaders, including Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of Kenya, Julius Nyerere, the long-term president of Tanzania, Nelson Mandela, many, many, many other African leaders. And I had a fertile interest in the problems of how U.S. aid and foreign assistance can sometimes exacerbate problems, political problems, cultural problems, the problems of hunger and poverty, rather than alleviating them. And, you know, a sensitivity to the idea that we need to be willing to listen to local leadership, and that we need to nurture community-based solutions.
There are certain things that one thought one knows. HIV equals AIDS equals death. And one of the things that became clear, and actually rather disturbing, was the fact that there was a view that was being expressed by people whose scientific credentials you can't question. It seemed to me that there had been a determined effort to exclude their voice, to silence it.
So let me ask you about HIV and AIDS.
Right.
Why did it take so long for medical researchers to realize there was a connection?
Well, when you say a connection, David, what do you mean a connection?
HIV leads to AIDS.
Oh, that was, well.
But I thought for a while people didn't recognize that that was necessarily the case.
Well, that we're called denialists who are really off the radar screen, so
okay.
We wouldn't even go there.
When he brought 24 scientists to Pretoria, I was there. 12 on one side of the issue, 12 on the other side of the issue. He wanted to hear all around the table what everybody thought and make a decision. How am I going to handle HIV/AIDS, public health, antiretroviral regimens, and so forth in South Africa?
I listened and heard the whole story told about our own country. It seemed to me that we could not blame everything on a single virus.
It's remarkable that he's still alive, we'll just say. His health minister, she had plastic lemons and pieces of garlic hurled at her because she had said garlic, lemon, olive oil is good to drink every day if you want to strengthen your immune system. Pharma-funded activist group, they showed up and pelted her. The cruelty, the bullying, the culture of just absolutely viciously going against anybody who spoke about natural remedies or the immune system or the human body.
Studies in unborn fetuses in which the mother is given AZT to determine whether or not you can prevent the onset in that 30 to 40% of newborn infants who become infected from an infected mother.
Get the virus, never mind the person, never mind the life. And that's Fauciism.
New York City's Administration for Children's Services had enrolled children in unnecessary and dangerous HIV and AIDS drugs trials during a 20-year period starting in the late 80s.
Anthony Fauci helped arrange for the drug companies to get access to children in foster homes in 7 states.
There was a children's center in New York, in the Bronx, called Incarnation Center, where foster children or children who were considered to have AIDS through PCR tests that were inaccurate were put in this medical center, and they were used for experimental drugs.
Some of the children were infants. Some of the children were not even HIV positive. Fauci, together with pharmaceutical companies, sponsored these experiments. I use the terminology that's used in the Nuremberg Code. These are experiments. They're not studies. These are invasive experiments.
If the children wouldn't take the drugs by mouth, then they would put in a gastric tube.
Some of the older children refused to take the drugs that were given to them because they were so horrible. So they surgically inserted a feeding tube in their tummies so that they couldn't resist.
And many of these children died. A potter's grave of 80 children. And these were all children of color.
My assignment was to go there. So I did. I went to Hawthorne, New York, and I located this grave site. And what it looks like if you're standing before it, it was a semicircle of large tombstones with names engraved on the tombstones. I remember there were stuffed animals and flowers and hearts and things adorning those tombstones. And I also remember there were flies buzzing around. There was a mound, a gigantic hole in the ground covered by astroturf, and it wasn't nailed down. It was just covered. And I went over and I took a corner of the astroturf, and I remember, you know, my heart was pounding. I lifted it up, and inside was just a lot of coffins. They were in there haphazardly. And apparently there was more than one child in each coffin.
The drug companies which have supported trials at Incarnation include some of the world's largest. They also refused to be interviewed for this program. Officials at the National Institutes for Health insist that any participation of children in drug trials should be voluntary in every sense.
These little children are regarded as throwaway children. Nothing really was done to punish those who broke the law.
Well, I visited the State Institution for the Mentally Retarded, and I think particularly at Willowbrook that we have a situation that borders on a snake pit.
I remember very well when I was 11 years old, my father kicking down the door of the Willowbrook State School, which he called a snake pit, because they were doing experiments on children with intellectual disabilities.
The children live in filth, but many of our fellow citizens are suffering tremendously.
You had a lot of money at stake with pharmaceutical companies, so there was huge incentives, and there was career incentives for doctors who were doing these kind of experiments.
Most people cannot imagine that there are people, especially medical doctors, which Dr. Fauci is, can disregard the humanity of people, including children. It was a horrific abuse, and because it was government-sponsored together with pharmaceutical companies, they had kind of free reign. New York State and New York City provided the children.
The Vera Institute, relying mostly on New York City Administration for Services documents, confirmed 80 deaths, and many other children suffered serious harm.
The 1986 Act was created and signed into law by Reagan.
It allegedly created a program for compensation of children who were injured by their vaccines or who died, and they would get some level of compensation. It was meant to make vaccines safer, and it gave virtually blanket liability protection to vaccine manufacturers and healthcare providers who were providing vaccines.
The 1986 Injury Compensation Act was a real game changer, because all of the drug companies that were making vaccines were deciding that they were going to not do vaccines anymore unless they got liability protection, because they were getting sued at every turn.
Now, the blanket liability protection created a boom town. It created a gold rush. The sad reality is a whole new industry of recklessly developed vaccines that are highly profitable. And it did not lead to compensation to children who were injured. And it absolutely did not lead to safer vaccines.
That's one of the tragedies that is across the board when it comes to public health. Because you see, when doctors join forces with government, they no longer comply with medicine's mission and sacred oath to first do no harm to the individual patient. They become agents of government, and they do what they're told.
A retrovirus is a primitive life form that has no capacity to replicate on its own, which is something that's true of all other viruses. The retrovirus injects its RNA into an existing cell where an enzyme called reverse transcriptase converts viral RNA into DNA, which is then inserted or spliced into the host cell's DNA.
In the late 1980s, when I was at the Salk Institute as a graduate student, when I was in my 20s, I was working on trying to understand how RNA gets packaged into retroviruses, because retroviruses were the leading way for gene therapy to be developed and potentially applied. That idea was, well, if you can use RNA as a drug, what would you use it for? So my belief was using RNA as a drug to produce a vaccine response by expressing a foreign protein. And so I worked on that and ended up finding a way to get RNA into cells. Once that set of technologies came together, I filed invention disclosures and eventually patents on the use of RNA as a drug.
So when I joined the pharmaceutical industry in 1988, there were in Britain something like 15 separate drug companies. There's a small number of very large companies, but they don't tend to discover many of their drugs in-house. They use experts internally to try and identify biotechs that are doing good stuff, and then they grab them for money, and then they complete the development process.
Once the mRNA technology had been developed, I left the Salk and went to this company called Vicel. Vicel was actually founded in part to develop antivirals for the AIDS virus under a Burroughs Wellcome contract. The patents were sold to Merck. Together with Vicel, they spent over $1 billion. They could never make it work because it was believed that it was functionally impossible to manufacture RNA at large scale. But what they did do during that period is keep anybody else from working on it because the patents had issued, which is why there's this 10-year gap, essentially, or more, really 20 years, between the discoveries in the late 80s and then the real initiation of research into RNA vaccines starting in the early 2000s.
AIDS vaccines is not about a solution. It's about a permanent industry. You know, it's like waiting for Godot. Godot doesn't ever have to come. The industry that they've created through the promise that they will somehow have produced this miracle to us is now one of the giant medical industries of the medical cartel. And it's irrelevant if they ever produce a vaccine. Nobody ever questions them. Congress has stopped even asking the question. They just appropriate the money to Tony Fauci year after year after year to keep this infrastructure of virologists, immunologists, of principal investigators. And all of the medical cartel is all in on it.
He had a bunch of international global health leaders that he invited to his home that was showing everyone in the tour of the house. And he said, "Can I have some time with you in my library, in this amazingly beautiful library?" And it was there that he said, "You know, Tony, you run the biggest infectious disease institute in the world, and I want to make sure the money I spend is well spent. Why don't we really get to know each other? Why don't we be partners?" Our interactions and our collaborations became closer and closer with tuberculosis, with HIV, with the vaccine trial.
The Department of Justice asked the federal trial court in Seattle to fine Gates a record $1 million a day for antitrust violations. Judge Thomas Benfield Jackson ruled that Microsoft had violated the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act prohibitions outlawing monopolies and cartels.
If you go back and look at Bill Gates' business history as the first top executive and founder of Microsoft, it's quite clear that he was very interested in acting as a monopoly.
We've all seen the footage of him testifying as he's rocking back and forth in a chair with his arms crossed in a kind of a rather odd behavior.
The Justice Department has charged Microsoft with engaging in anti-competitive and exclusionary practices designed to maintain its monopoly in personal computer operating systems.
The Microsoft Explorer decision caused Microsoft to divest from what was clearly a monopolistic practice with its browser technology to exclude other competitors.
He was really the most reviled businessman in the United States. And then suddenly, he became the philanthropist.
What he's done is taken his toolkit that he's developed in the pressure cooker of competition in the IT sector and turned those same practices towards public health and functionally has monopolized public health through his philanthropic giving that isn't really philanthropy. It's more of a screen behind which he has made other strategic investments that have produced a massive financial return.
You've invested $10 billion in vaccinations over the last two decades, and you figured out the return on investment for that. And it kind of stunned me.
There's been over a 20-to-1 return.
Modern billionaires that are also often referred to as philanthropists that are increasingly controversial have a lot in common with John D. Rockefeller's reputation. Prior to the beginning of his rebranding as a philanthropist, John D. Rockefeller was very much hated by the American working class for a variety of reasons. A large part of it being how he treated workers, but also his business style and the interest in his family and particularly himself in consolidating power.
In 1910, John D. Rockefeller really kind of took over medicine, particularly the medical schools. And they redirected medicine to be totally focused on pharmaceutical interventions and also various surgical procedures. In other words, to make it a real business. The Rockefellers are involved in everything. The World Health Organization, both Rockefeller and Gates.
He really points to his father, who's Bill Gates II, as sort of being a guiding reason as to why he's interested in directing a lot of the money of his philanthropy. And Bill Gates II was the head of Planned Parenthood during a time when it was rather different than it is today.
When I was growing up, my parents were always involved in various volunteer things. My dad was head of Planned Parenthood, and it was very controversial.
That same society also was with some of these Rockefeller eugenics-focused philanthropies at the time.
The very, very wealthy form foundations to eliminate their tax requirement. Foundations don't have to pay taxes. So they simply move their business under the flag of foundation, and then they're exempt from tax, and they gain huge control because they're distributing money to all sorts of non-government agencies. But they get to decide exactly who to give money to, what kind of policies to support, and guess what? In the meantime, they're shoveling in money for themselves.
The president of the Rockefeller Foundation, Dr. Rajiv Shah, joined the Gates Foundation in 2001, and in Africa, he directed the International Finance Facility for Immunization. Using sleight of hand, the IFFI enriches Gates' pharma partners with Western financial bonds by passing the cost to future generations in poor countries.
Starting with AIDS and going through SARS and MERS and Zika and bird flu, they have one thing in common: Fauci at the center.
We did SARS in 2002, MERS 2003, bird flu in 2005, H1N1 2009. This is the same playbook, different virus.
If you look at Anthony Fauci's tenure at NIAID, specifically after the 2001 anthrax attacks. He was responsible for the massive funding of numerous biosafety labs throughout the United States, several of which have engaged in gain-of-function experiments during that period of time.
24 hours after he received both the seasonal and swine flu vaccines, he was hospitalized.
If you really look at the scientific data, it is unclear why that happened. Clearly, the risk of the complication of the disease is greater than the risk of the vaccine.
Ended up being very, very fraudulent studies. I got a hold of that transcript, and I published excerpts from it in Rolling Stone and Salon simultaneously. And immediately, it was a storm of controversy pressuring Rolling Stone and Salon to take down the article. You get deplatformed if you tell the truth or if you say anything that challenges government orthodoxies. And they made a show of looking through a series of briefcases and files to try to find what they were looking for, and they said, we'll send them to you. And, of course, they never sent them. And at the end of that meeting, Tony Fauci came up to me and took me aside, and he said, I want to commend you for what you're doing. It's important work, and you keep us all on our toes. Oh, thank you. You can be the judge of how earnest he was.
Because he was considering a commission to look into ill effects of vaccines, and somebody, his name is Robert Kennedy Jr., was advising him that vaccines were causing bad things. And I said, no, that's a dead end. That would be a bad thing. Don't do that.
Soon after this announcement occurred, those gentlemen killed the Vaccine Safety Commission.
There's no doubt in anyone's mind there will be a surprise outbreak.
It was laying the groundwork for what they needed to do with the fear-based messages to put everybody on high alert, to actually have everybody start talking about this pandemic.
Here you have the government regulatory agency collaborating with a pharmaceutical company to keep secret the results of clinical trials on a drug that is now mandated to virtually everybody in America, for which the company has no liability. No matter how grievously you're injured, no matter how reckless or negligent their conduct, you can't sue them.
My wife Jill heard about this website that listed adverse events by batch. So she looked up the How Bad Is My Batch website and dialed in the batch numbers that I had received. And it turned out that my second dose was a batch that was known to have a very high number of adverse events and deaths based on the VAERS system. I speak about this being the largest experiment ever done on human beings. At a very fundamental level, we have no understanding of what we've done, and yet we have taken this synthetic molecule that's not really RNA and administered it to global populations.